Returning again this morning to the book of Job, we have been making our way through this rather lengthy book, but we are doing so, as you can see, in giant hops as compared to my typical approach to text, because I think that's really the right way to go at this. We could spend a lot of time, even as Calvin did, verse by verse through the book, but I think the better way for us anyways is to approach this in its large pieces. And this morning we have come now to the, I dare say, the conclusion of round three of the dialogue between Job and his friends. And I say it's the end, as you'll see in a moment. Last week we looked at Eliphaz's final speech in chapter 22, and Job responded to it, although you remember he really didn't respond to Eliphaz. He bypassed him and went off to something much more important. But this morning, then, we're going to come to Bildad's third speech, and he's going to begin to speak, and Job's just going to cut him off, right? You'll see that in a moment. And he's going to interrupt him with a consideration of the mystery of God's nature in chapter 26. And then he's going to begin a summary defense of his own righteousness before God, specifically before a God of great wisdom, in chapters 27 to 31. We're only going to get through chapter 28 this morning, though, which that will then end the dialogue, and it will give, as you will notice, no opportunity for Zophar to give a third speech. So Job is going to cut Bildad off in the midst of his third speech, and he's not even going to give Zophar another opportunity to speak. So, as I've said a number of times now, Job ignores the naive nature of his friends and turns his attention to the Lord of glory. Now, again, Calvin has wisdom from his sermons on this, and this morning I'd like to point out something that he says in Sermon 102 from this book, from the beginning of chapter 28, well, actually the latter half of chapter 28. And here's what he says, and this is important for us to think about as we move into this piece of text. There is much about life that we simply cannot understand. For God often withholds the fullness of his wisdom from us. God does not give us all of the information. We are, unfortunately, from our perspective, not from God's, from our perspective, we are left with much less than what we would really want in any given situation. God is not in the business of revealing everything because we cannot understand it. He doesn't reveal, not because he's withholding, but because he simply recognizes that even if he tried, what he would reveal would be beyond our ability to understand. Imagine an infinite God trying to pour out infinite knowledge to finite creatures. All right. Yet, what he has revealed, we must be content with, for that is all that is needed. So, our God could reveal much, much more, and we would often like him to, but we must content ourselves with the reality that what God has told us is all we need at this point. See, for Job, the concept of wisdom is the knowledge of all things. When Job speaks of wisdom, he doesn't use it in the traditional sense of knowledge properly applied. Okay, that's the biblical concept of wisdom, generally speaking. Knowledge properly applied. And that fits here. But for Job, wisdom is more simply the knowledge of all things. The wisdom of God is what God knows, all that he knows, especially what he keeps hidden. What we call the secret counsels of God, as in Deuteronomy 29:29, the secret things belong to the Lord. There are certain things that belong to us, yes. There are certain things that God has revealed to us, yes. But there is much in the secret counsels of God that he has not revealed to us. If that's true, and it is, wisdom then is not found in this world per se. By definition, if wisdom is inherent to God, because it's all of what he knows, then wisdom is not inherently found in this world. Yes, there may be parts of his wisdom that are available to us through the world, but the fullness of his wisdom is found only in him. And so wisdom is not found in this world per se, except as revealed to us by God, and only up to a point, namely what God knows to be useful for us. Here's how Calvin puts it, quote, "It is true that many will presume to be wise and will also boast of having all wisdom tied up in a neat package. But the fact is that God keeps it hidden. Consequently, we will gain nothing by going here and there looking high and low. Man will never attain wisdom by his own diligent efforts, for God is holding it in his hand. Let us also note carefully that he grants it by measure, and at the same time, let us know that our reason and understanding extend only to things here below and which concern the present life," unquote. You see, the reason for this point that Calvin is making is because Job's friends, in all of their speech-making, have provided no insight into Job's situation. Yes, they have said many true things. Yes, they have articulated many concepts which are true. We've looked at a few along the way. But in the end, the totality of their argument has provided Job with no insight. Job's friends are content with a view of God that is limited to a simplistic relationship between creature and creator, a simplistic little box that God lives in, according to them. It's one based on pure ritualistic conformity to an unknown standard. And I say unknown because I don't think they even know what the standard is. They just simply say, here's the box. Just confess everything and life goes on. Just confess everything and your suffering will be done away with. But Job is realizing more and more as you go through this book, more and more that his situation is part of the larger plan and purposes of God. And that his responses need to be appropriate to what is and what is not revealed. He's beginning to realize, okay, wait a minute, wait. There are some things that are revealed. And yes, you, my friends, have said a few things that are true. Your overall argument is false, but you do say some things that are true. Okay, so there is some wisdom in what you say. But God is not, in fact, giving me the totality of what I need to understand here. And he's beginning to realize that that's okay. He's beginning to realize that that is okay. In fact, that's even good. Instead of getting an answer, for example, as to why he is suffering, Job settles himself into recognizing that his sufferings may not actually have a reason. For God may not give one or need to. See, our problem very often in approaching this book, and the point that Calvin is making, is very often we come because we believe that we deserve an answer to everything. We believe we should have an answer. Why? Okay? Why did I get this particular illness? Or why did I have this particular financial setback? Or why did this happen to me? Or why did that happen to me, right? And we want an answer. We always want an answer, especially now in our post-enlightenment world where we think that everything has an answer to it, right? And so every time we have a cough, we go to the doctor, we're expecting him to give us an answer. And we're dumbfounded when he looks at us and goes, I don't know. I'm just a doctor. We think we deserve an answer, but Job is beginning to realize, wait a minute. Maybe there is no answer, and that is good enough. What if that is entirely what it is that God is trying to get across to me? Yes, God does reveal many things, but there are many secret things that God has not revealed. And the question is, how do we respond to situations where we do not have an answer? Job is beginning to realize this, and you're going to see it, I think, somewhat clearly in the response that Job is going to give here in these chapters. So here's what you're going to see this morning. Bildad's going to try again, but Job is going to cut him off, and Job is going to turn his full attention to the mystery and wisdom of God as the only source of comfort. All right, so chapter 25. This morning I'm going to read the entirety of Bildad's speech. Any objections? Verse 2. Dominion and fear are with God. He makes peace in his high heaven. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not arise? How then can man be in the right before God? How can he who is born of woman be pure? Notice how many times you've seen that question in this book. Here it is again. This has got to be the fourth, fifth time we've seen it in this book. Behold, even the moon is not bright, and the stars are not pure in his eyes. How much less man who's a maggot, and the son of man who's a worm. All right, now that's the point where he stops talking. I think the reason he stops talking is because Job goes, stop! Hold it. Now, you will notice that once again, Bildad tries to force Job into the corner. He's trying to turn Job's attention to his own sinfulness. Once again, he asks that rhetorical question, how can he who is born of woman be pure? And his answer, of course, is, well, no one can. Okay, so stop asserting it. Stop standing there and saying that you're righteous, okay, because you're not. You're unholy. You are, as he says, a maggot. The son of man, a worm, verse 6. Okay, so see where he's going again. Men are considered, from Bildad's perspective, men are considered worms before God by virtue of their sinfulness. Thus, Job, so are you. Stop thinking falsely about yourself. Stop asserting your righteousness. Stop asserting that you're suffering because of your righteousness. No, you're suffering because of your guilt. Again, Bildad's answer is far too simplistic. For Job to blame himself is wrong. So you see, Bildad tries again to get Job to punish himself as a sinner. All right? To stop seeing himself as righteous and to focus his attention on simply mollifying the deity. You know, that word mollify, right? Go, bow down, try to please him, try to satisfy him, figure out what it is that you did wrong, and satisfy him. So he's just going back to the same old well that they've been drawing water from all the way through this book. So Job cuts him off. And I think he cuts him off because he knows that these men simply don't get it. Okay? They may know a few things that are true, but they don't understand the bigger picture. They're so boxed into their religiosity, their ritualistic religiosity, that then they can't even consider the greater intention obvious in the situation. You see it? Bildad just immediately runs back to the same old, same old. In fact, these five verses are some of the most profoundly obvious revelations of what these men think. And this is why Job cuts him off. It's like, okay, Bildad, wait. That's all you guys have been saying. You haven't even considered the possibility that there might be something more. You don't even consider the possibility that there's something about the greater nature of God himself and his purposes in this situation. You haven't even considered that. You're so boxed in to your little worldview that you can't even think outside of it for a moment. Now, let me just pause there. Ain't that true of us so very often? I mean, isn't that true of us? Our circumstances make us so myopic at times that we are only focused on the moment, and I need an answer, I want a solution, and I'm not going to be happy until something comes to me. Give me a word, right? Give me a word. Give me a bit of wisdom. This is what we want. They're so boxed in, they can't even consider it. In fact, think about it like this. They haven't even considered for a second what the writer of this book tells us about Job in chapter 1. Not even for a moment have they stopped and said, wait a minute, Job, you were a man who you offered sacrifices for your children when they had parties because you were afraid that they might have somehow blasphemed the name of God. They didn't even take that into account, not even for a moment. So Job brushes off his friends' advice because he is connecting his circumstances to a much higher purpose and to a much higher God. Their little deity is nothing but a little silver statue that sits on an altar in their living room. That's all he is. Just go kneel down in front of him, confess whatever sin you have, and the deity will be mollified. That's all they can see. But Job steps back and goes, no, 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 no. Our God is infinitely more than that. So let's consider him. So Job cuts his friends off because he realizes they have no view of God other than this tiny little window that all they have of God. This tiny little picture. And let me tell you, this, my friends, is the primary problem of so much of what calls itself Christianity today. A tiny little view of God. A myopic little fixation on a God who solves our problems and makes us happy and whatever. And then when real problems show up, when real crises come to our door, we have no answer. No answer. Job says, oh, there is an answer, and it's greater than you men can think. And so this is where he goes now, starting in chapter 26. In chapter 26. Now, I want to consider 26, 27, and 28 as three distinct speeches. They're not, but I want to consider them that way, all right, just to make it a little easier to follow along, all right? Job is first going to look at, in chapter 26, mystery of God, all right? He's going to look at the mystery of God. I'm sorry, the majesty of God, wrong word, the majesty of God. And then he's going to consider the righteousness that comes only from God, in the next chapter, and then finally in the third, a consideration of the wisdom of God under which all of this is understood. Job is going to do something that his friends cannot do. He is going to go to a place that they cannot go because his friends represent a world of lost people. Lost people. Now, I'm not particularly fond of using the word lost to describe the world, all right? I know it's kind of a common term in much of Baptist life. We talk about lost people, right? Okay. I'm not typically inclined to that. I'm inclined to think of lost people as dead people, reprobate people, rather than just lost. Lost people have a tendency to look around and try to find a way out of it, right? But reprobate people are just dead. They're not looking for anything. But in this case, I'm willing to use the word lost people. Lost in that they stumble around in the dark looking for answers to life's realities. Looking for an answer. Groping in the dark, looking for an answer. There's got to be an answer to this. I mean, I think what we're seeing, it's just my opinion here, I think what we're seeing that has settled over Western civilization is a darkness unlike any other that's ever presented itself in human history. A darkness in which men who think they're smart cannot even figure out what is obvious anymore. The darkness is so deep that they literally can't see their hand in front of their face. And this is why they say the most outlandishly foolish things imaginable, right? I mean, we're living in a world in which you cannot pick up, you know, some news aggregate site and read a headline that doesn't show you the deepness of this darkness that we are sitting in. A world of lost people fumbling around in the dark looking for an answer. And even when the answer is staring them right in the face, they can't see it. It's right in front of them, they can't see it. They don't want to see it. They're blind. They're in the dark. But you see, God has drawn us to himself. The people of God have been drawn to God. Even as Christ himself said, we've been taken out of darkness and into light. We've been shown the nature of God. We've seen the true Christ. He has revealed the true Christ to us. And now that we see it, we can't unsee it. Now that we see it, we can't unsee it. Job sees it, and there's no going back. For Job, there's no going back. There's no longer a discussion of the simplistic, ritualistic religiosity of his friends anymore. It's like, that ain't going to do. I'm sorry. Go away. In fact, you'll discover in a few chapters that even God himself is going to condemn these men for what they have said. So Job is moving into a much larger world. He's moving into a much larger world. And that, I think, is the point of this book. It's not to, so many people take this book and approach it as though it's supposed to give us answers to the problems of life. But the book is really designed to do something very different than that. And Job is beginning to see it. It's not about you. It's never been about you. It's been about him. From the very beginning of this book, it's always been about him. And Job is beginning now to break out into the sunlight and see that. So in chapter 26 then, Job is going to answer, quote unquote, his friends. And he is going to consider here the majesty of God. Chapter 26, verse 2, how have you, talking to his friends, how have you helped him who has no power? How have you saved the arm that has no strength? How have you counseled him who has no wisdom and plentifully declared sound knowledge? With whose help have you uttered words and whose breath has come out from you? And what's the answer to the question that he asks? Nobody's. Your advice has not been helpful at all, and I will not listen to you anymore. With whose help have you uttered words? Your advice has been nothing but worldly wisdom. Your words have been nothing but hot air coming out of your face. Stop talking. It has not come from God, nor have you even attempted to consider his ways. Or we might say it like this, to listen to you and to listen to your shallow words is to miss out on something far greater. That's a fear, that should be, I should say, a fear of every preacher. That should be a fear of every preacher. That if you listen to my shallow words, you miss out on something much greater. Therefore, the focus should always be on something much greater. So now, Job turns away from his friends. And let me read from you selected verses of the rest of this speech. Verse 5. The dead tremble under the waters and their inhabitants. Sheol is naked before God, and Abaddon has no covering. Verse 10. He has inscribed a circle on the face of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astounded at his rebuke. Verse 14, behold, these are but the outskirts of his ways, and how small a whisper do we hear of him, but the thunder of his power, who can understand? Job turns now, instead of to his friends, to the majestic one. He turns to the truly majestic one who can answer his query. In verses 5 to 13, Job lists some of the things can only be ascribed to an omnipotent God. Omnipotent God, a God of all power. Job lists them here. That the place of the dead, Sheol and Abaddon, is naked, meaning fully visible to God. Who gets to see where the dead live? Only God. He hangs the earth on nothing. In verse 7, he hangs the earth on nothing. There it is, just floating in space. He hides the moon. Verse 9. I think that's a reference to an eclipse. We had one just not too long ago. He has inscribed a circle on the water separating light and dark, day and night, spreading across a spinning orb. In fact, if you look from space, very often darkness looks like an orb on the face of the earth. He stilled the sea. He determines the boundaries of weather, etc. Verse 14. Now, I'd have you note something here. For a man living more than 4,000 years ago, he sure seemed to know a lot about the natural world as we now see it in the so-called Age of Enlightenment. Apparently, he knows things about a spherical earth. Apparently, he knows much about eclipses and about space. For a man who never went to space, and nobody in his day ever saw the concept of space, apparently he knew much about it, etc., etc. But in verse 14, he says, these are but the outskirts of his wisdom. Now, you know what the outskirts are, right? The outskirts of a city are the parts of the city outside the edges of the city, right? The outskirts. The power exhibited by God in the things above are just the outside edges of his true power. The ability of God to hang a planet in space exactly where he wants it to be, perfectly set, 93.2 million miles from the sun, give or take, in the so-called Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold, right? Who can do that? Only God can do that. These are just the outskirts of his power. Yeah, God hanging one planet in there is nothing compared to a few septillion stars that he planted also in the heavens, with simply speaking them out of his mouth, and boom, there they were. Right? Just the outside edges of his true power. And Job says this. He says, how small a whisper do we hear of him? And what he means by that is we get just a tiny glimpse of the total power of God. We get just a tiny glimpse of it. Listen, God didn't even break a sweat to build this universe. All right? For him, it was a couple of days worth of work where he just spoke it, and there it was. How much more could he have done? How much more could he still do, right? How much more could an infinite God do beyond what he's already done? We stand in utter awe of what we see and think, huh, wow, when God could do infinitely more than even that. That's Job's point. How small a whisper do we hear of him? We hear just the tiniest fraction of who this God really is as we consider him. We get just a tiny glimpse. So what Job is recognizing is that the true answer to his circumstantial questions is held in the mind and heart of God, who is far greater by magnitudes than his simplistic friends or their advice. He says, the God I serve is so much greater than the God you have in mind that by magnitudes, it's what he's saying in these verses. In other words, in my opinion, okay, just my opinion here, in my opinion, this is the point where Job has been fully turned by God. This is the point where Job has been fully turned by God. Now, remember, take yourself back to chapter 1, right? Have you considered my servant Job? Okay, Satan, take your best shot. Oh, that didn't work. Okay, take another shot. Go ahead. But what's the point of it? The point is God attempting to demonstrate his power, what he's accomplishing, his purposes, his intentions. All right? Therefore, this, in my opinion, is the point where Job has now been turned by that purpose of God to see something else other than just the simplistic answer from his friends. This is where now his heart, mind, soul has been turned, and the only one that can do that is God. It's what God has been purposing in this matter from the beginning. As I said a moment ago, remember, this book is not about giving you an answer to suffering. You're going to dig and you're never going to find one, except the answer of pointing us to God. Let me put before you a principle that you need to bury deep in your conscious, subconsciousness and consciousness. The answers to all human questions is God Himself. Now, the magnitude of what I just said may have escaped you, but so let me say it again. The answers to all human questions is God Himself. Not the words that come out of His mouth. No, no. He Himself is the answer. Especially as He is now revealed in the person of the Son of God incarnate. This is an ontological question. God is the answer. Not what God does, not what God says, who He is the answer. Not in the answers per se, but in the person of Christ. He is the answer to everything. And our goal should be to seek Him. Often our goal is to seek answers. But our goal is to seek Him. Here's how Paul puts it in Colossians 3. The men are studying this book on Sunday nights. We're going to get to this passage in a couple of weeks. Here's what he says, quote, "If then you have been raised with Christ," if you've been raised with Christ, "seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things that are above, not on the things that are on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with Him in glory." See what Paul does there? Paul says, listen, I know you got problems. I know your life is full of difficulties. I know life is full of troubles. Seek Him. Him. He is all we need. Christ is all we need. So, in chapter 26 then, Job is turned, I think. Now he's realizing, wait a minute, the answer is not in answers. The answer is in Him. Who is He? Which leads him to chapter 27. All right, now, he's going to do this. He's going to look back upon himself in this moment, all right? That's okay. You'll see why in a moment. Verse 2. "As God lives, who has taken away my right, as the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak falsehood, and my tongue will not utter deceit. Far be it from me to say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days." What is he doing? He's doing what he's done all along. I am righteous. Bildad, Eliphaz, Zophar, you guys, you haven't proven your case. I'm telling you the truth. There's no deceit in my mouth. I know my lips will not speak falsehood. I hold fast my righteousness. Over against his friends' accusations, Job maintains that God has no beef with him. Why? Because God knows him. Now, let me make sure you understand something here. The righteousness that Job claims is not a righteousness of deeds. Okay? He's not making a claim here that he is sinless. No man can make such a claim. No one can say before the living God, I have not sinned. And you should not misconstrue that just because Job claims here to be righteous, that he is making some sort of confession of deeds. He's making a statement of his status. Who he is. Who he is at his soul. He says, I know what I am. I know who I am. I'm not claiming to be perfect. I'm claiming to be status-wise right with God. See, remember, we've talked about this before. We've been talking about it on Wednesday nights, particularly as we're working our way through the confession. The doctrine of justification by faith, the concept that's in the song By Grace Alone, justification by faith is the belief that God declares a man to be in a state of righteousness by virtue of a divine work of regeneration and effectual calling, which becomes faith in us. But it's a work of God from beginning to end. It's a work of God. Why? Because no man can change his state. You cannot change what you are by outward acts. It doesn't work. It never has. In the history of the world, no one has changed what they are by the things that they do. You are what you are. And what you do flows out of what you are. And so therefore, it is necessary for God to change our state. Again, that is an ontological reality. God must do this. When Job makes his claim of righteousness here, he's not making a claim that he himself has done all kinds of good deeds that has made him righteous. No man can make such a claim. And Job is beginning to realize it profoundly. In other words, Job is not seeing himself righteous because of his own personal deeds, but on the basis of what a majestic, all-powerful, earth-hanging, eclipse-producing God declares. The point of the previous chapter is, this is who God is. And the point of this little pericope is, and this is what God has declared. It has to be connected that way. Job is not seeing himself righteous because of his own personal deeds. Rather, he sees himself as only as he is because of what God has declared to be true. The proof of it is found in the verses to follow. Let me just read two of them, 11 and 12. I will teach you concerning the hand of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Behold, all of you have seen it yourselves. Why then have you become altogether vain? Here's what Job asserts. Job asserts that his friends ultimately know that righteousness and reprobation are with the Almighty. They're with the Almighty. Such things are determined not by men and their actions, but by God and his words. By God in his declarations, by God in his decrees and purposes and intentions within himself. Verse 12, why then have you become altogether vain? He looks at his friends and goes, you know this to be true, so why do you turn inward about this? Inward is the concept of vain, right? A vain person is concerned about themselves, right? They're concerned about their what they are. The vain person is the person who says, I am special and something. Just look at me. And so he says to his friends, why have you turned inward? Why have you turned vain to seek the answers to eternal matters instead of turning to the Almighty where the answers live? You've turned inward looking for answers to eternal problems. But eternal problems don't exist in us. Answers, I should say, to eternal problems don't exist in us. Answers to eternal problems exist where? In the eternal. Verse 11, he says, I will teach you concerning the hand of God. You need to understand, as I do now, that all matters of eternity lie in the hand of God. They lie in his power, in his choices, in his decrees. It is God that determines who is righteous and who is wicked. We don't determine that. Oh, I know we think we do, right? And sometimes we think like that, right? Oh, look what that guy does. He must be wicked. See what I just did there? See what I did? I ascribed his state by virtue of his outward behavior. And then we look at other people and say, well, look at that guy. Look at, he must be righteous because look at all the wonderful things he does. And yet the scriptures tell us that both of those things can be false. That sometimes the righteous man, the outwardly righteous man, is not that at all, but rather is nothing but a wolf in sheep's clothing. And we're warned over and over again to watch out for men who outwardly look good, but inwardly are ravenous wolves, right? The point being, the outward deeds do not necessarily represent what we are internally. Now, they will have for us a great deal to tell us about what the nature of the man is. Because, yes, I fully agree that the nature of a man flows out of the deeds that he does. But that's the proper order. It's not the other way around. We are not made righteous by doing righteous things, and we're not made wicked by doing wicked things. We're wicked, therefore we do what is wicked. We're righteous, therefore we do what is righteous. Human beings struggle with that all the time. In fact, we've struggled with that since the Garden of Eden, because I think that's exactly what Satan tempted Eve into thinking. If you eat from this tree, you will be like God. Notice the behavior leads to an ontological reality. It was a lie. That was partly true. They would know good from evil. Unfortunately, they would know it the hard way. So, in verses 13 to 23, then, here's what Job does to make his point. He does it very ironically, I think. He lists the various judgments awaiting the reprobate, meaning those that are passed over by God in his grace towards his elect. He lists the various judgments awaiting them, what their fate will be as all things are reckoned by God. And he gives a whole list of them. I'm not going to read them, but I'll have you just look at one in verses 16 and 17. Okay, speaking of a man now, and this is a man. He says, though he heap up silver like dust and pile up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the righteous will wear it. Isn't that interesting? He says, yeah, you got men out there who are piling up silver like dust, meaning they're getting wealthy. Man, they have wealth beyond imaginations, right? The Bill Gates / Elon Musks / Jeff Bezos of the world, right? They're piling up the silver like dust. But they're not going to keep it. They can't. Because you can't take it with you, right? There will be no U-Haul behind Elon Musk's hearse carrying with him all of his stuff into the afterlife. It stays here. It stays here. Notice what Job is doing. Notice what Job is doing. The wicked are demonstrating that they are wicked, but in the end, it is God that is going to bring justice and judgment. And the reprobate will get what God has purposed. See it? Their destiny is not in their hands. Oh, they think it is. But it's not. And none of us get to control what happens to us after we die. That's the point. Now, it is true that the reprobate are given the common grace of God in this world. Yes, it is a great blessing on these men that God has poured out such fantastic wealth upon them. But their fate is, as it says in verse 20, like terrors that overtake them like a flood. Their destiny is fixed by God, not by them. Now, that should make us shudder. It should. My destiny, your destiny, is not in your hands. You will not determine your eternal destiny. That's not up to you. I know many parts of evangelicalism today, they say it is, right? If you will pray the prayer, and if you will do this, and if you will do that, then you will go to heaven when you die, as though you somehow have the ability to determine your own destiny. It's false. It's always been false. In fact, I would argue that you and I control very little in this world, don't we? I mean, really, how much do we really control in this world? Very little. So, the fact of the matter is that destiny is fixed by God. And Job now recognizes that eternal matters, like righteousness, are in the hands of an almighty God. The fate of a man is determined by a God who hangs the earth in space, who brings eclipses when he wants to, changes the weather patterns as he desires, and even marks out where day begins and night ends. That's who gets to decide the destiny. So unlike his friends, Job is now seeing who he is through God's eyes. You see it? You see it? Job has turned. He's turned away from his bloviating friends and their naive and simplistic view of God, and he's turned to see a greater God. He's turned to see a God so great that even the fate of a man is in the hands of the Almighty. And that, my friends, is where the gospel starts. The first thing we've got to do, the first thing we've got to recognize is, I am not at the center of the universe, and the world does not revolve around and my little problems, right? Got to start there. So Job has considered in chapter 26 the majesty of this God. Okay, so he's rightly ascribed the God he now sees. And then in 27, he's turned and recognized, yes, and that includes the fact that my eternal status is also determined by this God. But now in chapter 28, he confesses that wisdom is only found in God. How do you put those two things together? Here's a majestic God, and here's my fate. How do I connect the two of those together? Okay, that's chapter 28. Verse 1. Surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold that they refine. Iron is taken out of the earth, and copper is smelted from the ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out the farthest limit, the ore in gloom and deep darkness. Verse 9. Man puts his hand to the flinty rock and overturns mountains by the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up streams so that they do not trickle, and the thing that is hidden he brings out to light. But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. Here's what Job says. Wisdom, understanding, making sense of it all is not found in the excavations of men rooting it out in the earth. To search for wisdom in a fallen world amongst fallen men is a task of folly. In verses 1 to 11, Job paints a marvelous picture of men excavating the earth, searching for precious things. He lists silver and gold and iron and copper and sapphires. It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for men searching the world looking for wisdom and not finding it. I mean, they're literally, metaphorically speaking, digging up mountains looking for it, right? They're drilling deep shafts in the earth and going down in them and looking for the precious things. It's a picture of men going out into the world and digging around in the dirt looking for the precious things. But metaphorically, it's men looking for wisdom. In other words, the shaft of verse 4 is an opening in the earth leading to a treasure trove of wisdom. But Job asks the question, verse 12, where shall it be found? Where shall wisdom be found? Is there a place where wisdom can be found here? And then in verses 14 to 19, he extends the metaphor by saying, and it can't be purchased even. You can't buy it, even if it could be found. In those verses 14 to 19, he lists precious things that cannot buy wisdom from the earth. You can't buy it with gold, silver, onyx, sapphire, glass, jewels, coral, crystal, or topaz. Doesn't mention $20 bills here, but the point is the same, right? Wisdom is not a thing of this world. It is not inherent in this world. In verses 20 to 22, Job concludes with, it is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. So he starts by saying, okay, there's a majestic God in which all wisdom can be found. And so now in this chapter he says, and the wisdom is not found in this world. It can't be bought, can't be derived from the earth. It can't be just dug up and people... No. In many ways, this is a slap in the face of the scientific method. We can determine how things work, right? Because we can examine them and we can use the science, with a capital S, to find out where these things are, right? We can examine and figure out and determine, and we can call ourselves men of science and we can give answers. But God sits in his heaven and laughs and says, I've got more wisdom in my pinky than you have in 10,000 years of human history. Wisdom is not a thing of this world. And so Job now turns and says, wisdom is only found in God. Verse 23, God understands the way to it and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and he sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then he saw it and declared it. He established it and searched it out. The it in all those is wisdom, right? And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn away from evil is understanding. He says, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. Verse 24. God, the omniscient one. God, the all-knowing one. As he already described him two chapters earlier. This God, who is greater than all things, he is the source of all true wisdom. And guess what? The fear of the Lord is true wisdom. Look, Book of Proverbs hadn't been written yet. If Job lived around, say, 2000 BC, it's going to be another 1,000 years before the Book of Proverbs will be written. But it fits perfectly with what the writer says in Proverbs 9:10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. To truly seek God is to find the answers to all matters of living in a fallen world. Seek what? Him, not answers from wise men, but him. So Job has come to understand two things. Number one, God is the inexhaustible source of all wisdom and knowledge. Because he is God, all of what can be known is found in God himself. God is wisdom. God is light. I think someone in the New Testament wrote of that. For all the knowledge of all that there is to know is found in him. And it's not just something he possesses, by the way. It's kind of like we often look and go, yeah, God's full of wisdom. No, God is. Okay? Ontologically, God is wisdom. Just as he is light, just as he is love, just as he is everything, he is wisdom. He is the very essence of wisdom itself. So Job has come to understand that. And secondly, Job has also come to realize something else that follows with it. It's very important to consider here now. God has not revealed all that there is to know. By the time you get to the end of chapter 28, you're left with a question. And the question is, so there is no answer to what Job is experiencing? Oh yeah, there is an answer. But it isn't made known here. Because it's in the nature of God. God reveals what we need to know in order to live according to his purposes, but no more and no less. Remember what it says at the end of chapter 28, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn away from evil is understanding." What he has made known to us is turn away from evil. Okay? He's made that known. I mean, his friends were right on that point. They were wrong on their conclusions, but they were right on that point. Yes, turn away from evil. And Job says that's right, because God has made that known. But as Calvin said, as I pointed out at the beginning of the sermon, God grants knowledge by measure. His words. What we need at any given moment is available to us. Everything else he keeps in his secret counsels. Everything we need at the moment has been made known to us, but not everything has been made known to us. So here's what we know that Job did not know. In Christ, the fullness of God's revelation is completed, such that everything needed for life and godliness has been made known to us. 4,000 years after Job, we now have all that God wanted to tell us when it comes to life and godliness. To have a relationship with him, to know him, he's revealed it all. It's right here in this book that he providentially inspired and preserved for us to read. Even the story of Job, ironically, it's here. Or as Paul says it in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 20 and following, "Where's the one who is wise? Where's the scribe? Where's the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God." Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. "For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." Paul says, what God has revealed is all we need. But he's given to us everything we need. Right here are the answers to everything. They may not answer the specific reason why you are dealing with a particular difficulty, why you are suffering with a particular thing, why Job is sitting on a hill scraping himself with a piece of pottery. There's no answer given. But there is a God, and our focus should be on him. Job has begun to realize that. It's not about me. It's not about my little sores. It's about him. And that is what we have in Christ. But let me tell you this, rather frankly. What God has revealed to us is more than we can understand in a lifetime. God has poured out much more than what we actually need to make it in this world. So again, a message comes from Job. A simple message comes out of this book. God reveals to us only what he thinks we need. Sometimes all we can do is be content in our circumstances, trusting in God. There may not be an answer because God may not have given us one, but he is the answer, particularly Christ Jesus, the Lord. And we should be content with that. Job is becoming content with his realization that, you know what, it's not about me, it's about God. Good for him. But we need to be content with that as well, because we have much greater knowledge than Job did. We have the whole story outlined for us. We have all that God wanted us to know. So we can't be like Job. I mean, we can't be like Job's friends, floundering around the dark looking for an answer. We have an answer. It's Christ Jesus the Lord. That's our answer.